From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition. Now, Mary Kissel.
A vaccine scandal in China raises questions about the foundations of the regime, and growth is slowing in the world's second largest economy. Is it Donald Trump's fault? Welcome to Foreign Edition. I'm Mary Kissel, and I'm joined by my friend and colleague, Hugo Restall, who is at an undisclosed location somewhere out there in Asia Pacific. Hello, Hugo.
Hi, Mary. Good to talk to you again.
Great to have you on, as always. A major scandal erupting in China. Authorities have arrested the chairwoman of Changsheng Biotechnology Company after disclosing that the company's vaccines to protect against diphtheria, whooping cough, and tetanus didn't meet safety standards. Hugo, this is really quite extraordinary. One of the country's largest vaccine makers, hundreds of thousands of children may have been injected with this bad medicine. How in China, where there's no free media or NGOs or really any accountability of any type, how did this scandal come to light?
Well, it does appear that the authorities belatedly discovered it by conducting an inspection this month. But there are also some reports that the authorities knew about the problem a year ago. And that, of course, is exacerbating the anger. So it was only this month that the authorities released the information. But there are many unanswered questions about whether the officials that were supervising this company were corrupt, because there have been several scandals of that type in the past involving vaccine makers. Or was it just incompetence, or, was the company, fooling everybody by falsifying these records?
Well, you can always gauge the severity of a scandal in China, I think, by the reaction of the top leadership. And you had an immediate statement from Xi Jinping, who was traveling in Africa, calling this scandal, quote, terrible and shocking. Li Keqiang saying he would resolutely crack down. Hugo, as you said, though, we've seen these scandals erupt in the past. What can Xi and Li really do if they don't change the fundamental nature of the system? I mean, how do you have policing of companies if you don't have, you know, truly free markets and a really, you know, free press and the like?
Right. So far in the handling of this, there's nothing to say that this this case will be any different from previous cases. That is, people are allowed to vent their anger online. The censorship regime on the internet has not so far removed people's angry messages, as long as they don't, call for the overthrow of the Communist Party or the like. But expressions of anger against the company are being allowed, and that allows people to vent for a period of time. And then what typically happens is after a few officials are forced to resign and the company managers are arrested and the public anger dies down, then the censorship regime goes back into operation and no further comment is really allowed. And there's no follow-up by the press. There's no class action lawsuit or activist lawyers, trying to uncover similar cases. And so there is no real lasting accountability. That's because the Communist Party's overwhelming concern is the preservation of its own image and power. And so, pharmaceutical companies are a major part of Xi Jinping's economic growth policies. He's propping them up. They're part of his stimulus. And so it's very likely that once this dies down, pharmaceutical companies will come back under the Communist Party's protection.
Yeah. And for all of those out there that have said in the past, Tom Friedman, that China has some fantastic new model of growth. Well, wake up. It kills people. It literally kills people not to have this kind of accountability that we enjoy in Western liberal democracies. Hugo, you said earlier that the authorities may have known about this for months, if not a year or longer. That reminds me of the SARS scandal back in the early 2000s, where Chinese authorities knew that disease was, which was a deadly disease, was spreading rapidly, and yet covered it up. And that was in the early 2000s. I mean, you're talking about decades and decades of this stuff going on.
Right. I mean, in 2008, the most notorious food safety scandal of all was the poisoning of milk for infants, which a major milk powder company was complicit in the adding of melamine, a chemical, to the milk powder, which killed at least six infants and left 300,000 ill, and has had a lasting effect on the psychology of Chinese parents, because they want to buy their milk powder now from abroad, and so they're constantly traveling abroad to buy it or smuggling it back into the country. So in a country where really nothing, no product can be trusted, there are food safety scandals on a smaller scale almost daily. And for this to be happening again to children is a particularly explosive issue. So,
Hugo, it reminds me when I moved to Hong Kong in the early 2000s, a friend of mine said, you read papers in the West, to get news. Well, here you read the paper so you don't die. So one week it's lettuce, the next week it's chicken, the week after that it's milk. I mean, it's funny, but it was true.
Right. Yeah. So the distrust is endemic, and that has very lasting and dangerous consequences for the regime. You see it in the wealthy Chinese who want to move abroad. I mean, surveys are conducted year after year, which show that a large proportion of China's wealthy are moving their families out, moving money out, want their children to go to universities overseas so that they will be able to live overseas, because they know that the quality of life is so much better. Even if the economic opportunities for them are not as great, at least they won't be poisoned by the air or by the food or by the drugs that their doctor gives them.
Well, it also raises questions about our relationship with China here in the United States. You had the Food and Drug Administration issuing a voluntary recall of a blood pressure medication called Valsartan earlier this month. I'm not sure we should be importing anything from the pharma space from China, given the lack of accountability that you've just outlined.
Right. There was a very famous case in 2007 where a Chinese company was selling ethylene glycol, which is poisonous, as glycerin, as an ingredient to cough syrup, to Panama, and it ended up poisoning hundreds of children around Latin America. So, yeah, it's a really big question of how do you where do you draw the line? I mean, there's lead paint in toys from China that that have been sold in the U.S. Yeah, it's
a tough problem.
Nothing can really be totally trusted, and it's a question of risk management.
Well, yeah, and it's also a question for policymakers who I think ultimately would be held responsible, at least in this country, were anyone to, God forbid, be affected by a faulty product or medicine, bad medicine from China. Hugo, what I don't understand is why the Trump administration doesn't try harder to explain these basic dysfunctions of the system to the Chinese people. You're always seeing Trump wanting to talk to Xi Jinping, Pompeo or Mattis going over for official visits. But the Chinese people themselves understand just how horrific this is. Why not press to give them more news of the outside world, to give them a glimpse of, the fact that in the United States or in Britain or elsewhere, you don't have to worry about things like vaccines.
Yeah, I think Donald Trump could very well talk about these issues more. I think it's not so much a question of telling Chinese people about this.
Yeah, they know.
Of course, they know. But just sort of emphasizing it and giving them the reassurance that things are different in the U.S. and that this is a major political difference between the two systems, and showing some pride in the American system that has overcome problems like this, and you know, encouraging the Chinese to demand similar rights.
We're talking about China's bad medicine, and you're listening to Foreign Edition from The Wall Street Journal.
Your Money Briefing will explore what you need to know to become a homeowner and how to sustain your home by learning ways to manage the costs from unexpected expenses.
You're basically always in a state of checking. You're always keeping your eye open for anything that could be going wrong with your house. Your house is a complicated machine. It has a lot of systems and components in it, and those systems and components are getting older. They're wearing out.
You can get early access to our series, Buying a Home and Keeping It, on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
Drive time, gym time, anytime. Podcasts from the Wall Street Journal. Check out all our shows at wsj.com/podcasts. That's wsj.com/podcasts.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition. Now, Mary Kissel.
Welcome back to Foreign Edition. Mary Kissel in New York with Hugo Restall. Somewhere out there in Asia Pacific, maybe at the beach, maybe in the jungle, we're not so sure. Hugo, I want to stay on China, or as the president calls it, China. Economic growth slowing. Second quarter GDP coming in at around 6.7% earlier this week. That is slightly lower than the market anticipated. It may sound like a decent growth rate to citizens in the West. More than 6% growth, that sounds big. But in China, it is not. Hugo, why? And why is growth slowing down?
Well, also, first of all, it needs to be said that we can't take those figures at face value. I mean, it's quite possible that growth is slower than 6.7%. There have been major slowdowns, for instance, 2014-15, where we think that growth was much slower than the official figures. This time, I don't think the slowdown is too bad, but a lot of other things are going on that show that the financial system is under stress. You've seen some big stock declines. There's a decline in exports. Private sector investment growth, I think, is a big one. That's been falling. Peer-to-peer lending platforms have been going under. Hedge funds are under pressure.
The currency losing value and weakening versus the dollar?
The currency has lost 6.9% in the last 3 months. So a fairly major decline. And of course, Donald Trump has taken note of that and has interpreted that as China using its weaker currency as part of the trade war. I think that's a bit of a reach because this is definitely being driven by market forces, although he is right that the yuan's value is always manipulated by the government, is always controlled. So the fact that they're letting it decline in response to market forces can be seen as something of a policy choice. But I think the bigger picture is that the economy is under a fair amount of pressure at the moment, and that's due to internal causes rather than the trade war.
Well, just to be fair and balanced, every currency is manipulated by its central bank. The U.S. dollar is, quote-unquote, manipulated by the Federal Reserve. I don't want listeners out there to think that we're being unfair toward Beijing. We're trying to give you both sides. Hugo, this is really, though, a remarkable trend, given how strong growth is in the world's largest economy, the United States, and how growth has recovered in continental Europe. Britain, of course, accepted as they muck up Brexit. So when you say that it's market forces within China that are slowing the economy, are there things that the authorities are doing to prevent a better, more sustainable growth? Or is it the threat of more tariffs that is preventing or dissuading Chinese businesses from, you know, putting forward that capital investment that you need to drive growth in the future?
I think it's definitely the result of policy choices. The private sector investment being down is a prime example. It's that the People's Bank of China and the technocrats within the Chinese government are trying to rein in the excessive growth of credit in recent years, trying to control growth of leverage in certain companies that were where their borrowing was out of control, and control the shadow banking system, that is lending outside of the banks through off-balance sheet vehicles and other means. And so that is depressing lending, particularly to the private sector, because the private sector has never been able to borrow that much from banks and has relied on the shadow banking system. So in general, from a view of 30,000 feet, I'd say this is very positive that the Chinese government is trying to get a handle on excessive credit growth. But
it's kind
in
of
the
a
short
pro-
term, of course, it's causing a lot of pain.
Yeah, and it's kind of a problem of their own making, isn't it, Hugo? Because
right.
back in 2008 and 2009, kind of the depth of the financial crisis, Beijing really turned on both the monetary and the fiscal taps, and regional governments went nuts, spending the money and creating a kind of artificial growth that really didn't have its roots in price signals or traditional supply and demand, and so you had China kind of front load its growth and then start to suffer the consequences as they saw asset bubbles pop up everywhere and property and other things. So, Hugo, is this still then the effect of that, blowout so many years later?
Yes.
Really?
Definitely. I mean, the stimulus was not just one episode, of course. It was ongoing. And whenever there was a slowdown in the economy, stimulus would be picked back up and, the money taps would be opened again. And that's somewhat happening again now. There's talk of more fiscal stimulus, but the really interesting thing I think is that there's signs of internal conflict over economic policy within the government. I mean, we really have to read the tea leaves here. It's like the old Kremlinology,
right?
There were some things in the Chinese press, open conflict between the officials at the People's Bank of China, the central bank, and the finance ministry over how to stimulate the economy. Basically, the PBOC was saying, you guys in the finance ministry should be spending more, take up the stimulus role, and let us go on deleveraging and fixing the financial system. Don't make us inject tons of liquidity into the system and undo the good work, that we've been doing. The PBOC may be losing that battle because on Monday it injected $74 billion, a fairly big injection of liquidity and long-term funding into the banking system. But all these other rumors we've been hearing of conflicts that Xi Jinping might actually be in trouble, he sort of disappeared from the front page of the People's Daily recently. Mm-hmm. And there were coup rumors flying around Beijing. And, a lot of this stuff is pretty wild, but it sometimes is an accurate reflection of some kind of policy conflict. And, there's the Politburo meeting that was supposed to be happening around this time, the end of this week, on economic policy. So that may be something of a showdown.
I guess the other factor here, too, is how Xi Jinping has rolled back reforms of prior administrations in that he's increased regulatory intervention in the economy, in that he is dissuaded certain kinds of foreign direct investment by, piling on to Korean firms or Japanese firms or other kinds of foreign competitors that he doesn't like or doesn't want in the country. I mean, that has to have an impact too, doesn't it?
Yes, definitely. And he's definitely increased support for the state-owned enterprises, which are the least efficient and most wasteful parts of the economy, but also the politically the most reliable. So he's sort of gone back to the old school Maoist economic model to some extent. He's definitely opposed by some technocrats within the government who would like to be more reformist. And speculation is that Li Keqiang, who was largely sidelined on economic policy in the early years of Xi Jinping's rule after he came to power in 2012, may now be making something of a comeback as these debt problems, the size of these debt problems become obvious to everybody.
Hugo, does the administration in Beijing have full and complete control over the various regions in China and how they conduct their fiscal policy or not?
That's an interesting question. There's definitely have been problems with local governments. Their spending being out of control. I think they've reined that in by and large. But you know, that's still a huge overhang of debt that is one of the things destabilizing the financial system.
Well, and also, you know, again, points to just the core dysfunction at the heart of a one-party state, that there's no political accountability for these guys and no outside scrutiny either from third parties, you know, whether it's market participants voicing their views or the free press or anything like that. I mean, you know, I know I sound like a broken record, Hugo, but I just can't help remind listeners that it wasn't so long ago, maybe only a decade ago, that we were being told that China was the great new thing and the United States should be more like China. Well, I guess now we're seeing the tide pull out and we're seeing it in its all of its ugliness.
Right. And we have to be concerned that as economic problems and internal contradictions within China get worse, the temptation may be to ramp up nationalism, perhaps choose a big devaluation of the yuan, blame it on Trump. You know, these are options, nuclear options that I'm sure that the Chinese policymakers do not want to use. But if in extremis, you know, they may end up doing that, and it may have significant foreign policy repercussions for U.S.-China relations.
Well, ending on a gloomy note, as usual. That's it for Foreign Edition today. On behalf of my friend, Hugo Restall, thank you for listening. You can contact us at Hugo Restall and at Mary Kissel on Twitter. We'll be back with you later this week.